Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, this is Jessica Chotan,
Stacey Muncher,
and Lisa Hollander,
and we are going to
turn the page.
And we're sitting here with author
Tara Clancy.
And Tara Clancy wrote one of our absolute favorite books.
It's a staff pick.
It is a staff pick.
By multiple members of the staff.
Us.
All three of us.
Wow. Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
So we're very honored to have you here.
Yes, thank you for coming.
Oh,
yes,
thanks for having me. Thank you. Here we are, live at the library. Yes. I love it.
So I think the first thing I wanted to know is, this is kind of jumping towards the end, but I see you're wearing your 90s flannel, and as a flannel girl, like, there was a part in the book that talks about the alternative girls versus the girls that listen to hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
That resonated with me so much.
Yeah, yeah. Growing up in Queens, it was hard to escape hip-hop, which is funny for people to understand. But I'm like, you know, Queens in the 90s, like, I had to seek out rock music. Like, that wasn't, you know, you couldn't find it. But I did. I did, and I found it. And then I kind of, like, I turned my back on hip-hop for a little while. Like the pendulum had to swing. And now I'm sort of like, well, no, I love some hip-hop, too. You know, but when I was a kid, I'd be like, I hate it. You know, I'm into right. rap music.
Yeah.
You know, but now it's kind of like everything's leveled out a little bit. Yeah.
I think that's kind of a big thing just in general with adolescence. I mean, I know for me, it was like when I was younger, it was like you had to love one thing and shun everything else. Yes. And then as you get older, you're just like, hey, there's room for everything. I can like hip hop. I can like classic rock. I can like alternative.
Yeah.
You know, you're not turning your back on one if you like a little bit of everything or all of it.
I mean, ultimately, I guess that's a lot of what my book, which is a memoir, which is true, which is about my life, is really about. Is you don't have to shun one thing. I know I will plagiarize myself, but I call myself like a kindergarten chameleon, a kindergarten zealot, right? Because I grew up in these like various different worlds, you know. So, you know, because my mom's involvement with this with wealthy man meant I had a sort of dual life, right? On the one hand, like going out to the Hamptons, and on the other hand, being this Queens kid who, you know, went to public schools and hung out on street corners and was in every way, you know, your average Queens kid. But then it was like this melding of the world. You know, my mom gets involved with this guy, and for 20 odd years, you know, my life was kind of going back and forth, and realizing that I didn't have to pick one or the other, and that there was good things in both. You know, that there was great things about having a party in a Queens basement, and that in many ways beat an amazing fancy party in a Hamptons mansion. You know, that one was not necessarily better or more fun than the other, which was funny, right? It was like, it was kind of a blessing. Like, it let me off the wheel of life, right? Where you're like, lots of Queens kids are like, oh, I just want money, I just need a house, I just want this. And I was like, you know what? Like, I kind of got this taste of it. It wasn't necessarily like a ticket, right? Because my mom didn't take anything from him. We weren't necessarily moved out of Queens, but, you know, she was proud. But I got this taste of it, and I was like, you know what? It's not something you need to strive for. You can have as much fun, you know, in a Hamptons mansion as you can in a Queens basement. Bottom line, I hold to that forever.
No, I would say that's really good because that resonates. I mean, like, I'm younger than both of you guys, at least here. And just for someone of where in the mindset of like all your friends are like, oh my God, we're getting married, we're having kids, we need a house, we have no room for a house. I mean, we're here on Long Island, but
yeah
you could be fine in an apartment.
Yeah,
I mean, I say that and I know I want a house, but like, Just saying.
Yeah, but you know, it is an interesting little thing to kind of, to actually get a taste of the thing that everybody's striving for, right? I mean, this was like classic. It was a Bridgehampton mansion. It was the thing everybody wanted. And we had a blast. But the reason we had a blast is because my entire Brooklyn Italian, Queens, you know, friends were there. That's what made it fun. And it was the people. And I mean, we could, like, I mean, was it nice to have a pool? Yeah, you bet. You know, but if there wasn't a pool, like, we could still have as much fun, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because where I'm living right now in Levittown, there are these town pools. So, you know, I mean, there are people who get together at the town pool and hang out. And then there are the people who prefer to just kind of do it in their backyard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't know. But I guess you don't really miss out on one if you have both.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because I didn't ever really have that. That, his world, that Hampton's world, that, like, you know, upper class world was never really mine. And I always knew that, right? Like, I knew that I, again, it was just a taste. It wasn't a ticket. It was just, you know,
The limo.
Yes.
On the weekend.
I did. I mean, I got a charter planes, you know, from LaGuardia Airport in Queens, you know, to Bridgehampton. You know, I really got a great taste of it, and the restaurants and the culture and that stuff. I mean, it was all amazing, and I love it. I love that stuff still. I take some of it with me. He brought me up going to like museums and things that wasn't as popular amongst the families I knew in Queens, and I've been, you know, into art and since then, thanks to him. But I don't have a ton of money. You know, I'm an artist and a writer, and I think I took the best out of that, you know, even though that didn't necessarily mean dollars, you know?
Of course, yeah. And dollars doesn't necessarily equate
happiness.
Exactly.
No. Yeah. Yeah. But we could say it a million times, right? And people are like, well, you know.
Yeah. People are like, but it'll make me happier if I can buy this, like, $50,000 car.
I mean, the thing that I like to, you know, about my own life, which happens to also be my own book, is that it kind of, you know, we have this myth, and I think it's really, you know, icky, that of the gold digger woman, right?
Yes,
of, especially of a woman like my mom, who is born and raised in Brooklyn, you know, the first and only person in her family to graduate college. She, you know, you would, who met this man as his cleaning lady. I don't want to spoil this, by the way, for anybody who has not read the book.
It's amazing. Even with spoilers, it's so worth reading.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll try to hold back a little bit. But, you know, you think that kind of woman gets involved with the rich guy, and she's all, like, right? There's that gold digging, you know. And here she comes along and literally is like, you know, for a couple of reasons, decides she doesn't want to live with him. They were completely in love, but for 20 years they never lived together full time. It was always really saw each other on the weekends. And she most certainly never took any money, right? She was really like, I want to raise my kid my way. That has to mean on my dime, right? Like, she had this amazing philosophy, if you take somebody's money, you have to take their advice. And so she was like, no way, you know. Also, I'm sure, I think it was probably a subconscious level then, but she wanted to sort of show me that was, you know, she was upholding this lesson of, this isn't about, like, you know, coming in, you're an independent woman, you make your own way, you make your own decisions, and we don't, you know, we welcome what he can offer, and it's fun, but, you know, I we don't need it, and somebody doesn't have to come in and pay my bills, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, she really turned on its head the idea what people think happens when a working class woman gets involved with an upper class guy.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
Yeah, and I just love her for it. You know, I love the lesson that that's there. And then she really changed his life in the end, you know, by bringing into his world all these people that he just found colorful and smart and interesting. And, you know, I talk about it in the book, and then I've talked about it on The Moth. I guess for anybody who doesn't know, I'm a frequent storyteller on The Moth on NPR, and I'm a host of The Moth live shows. And the story that I tell a lot is a story about Mark kind of taking my friends from Queens and me, and sort of having these really intense, big conversations with us that my mom dubbed the moon and stars talk. She would say, are you going to talk about the moon and the stars all night? And he would sort of talk to us like we were his peer. He would argue with us. He would keep us, you know, expect us to keep up. And just having that interaction with somebody who's so different from us but treated us with respect and, as you know, valued our intelligence, really changed all of our lives, you know. So it was mutually beneficial. You know, we got a pool and some really deep conversation. He got to have all these colorful, fun people around him. Yeah. It was a heck of a life. It was a heck of a life. I love my life. I'm a very happy person.
So what inspired you to write about it?
That's a good question. Because I started off really as, well, you know, telling stories and being a performer, and I wrote solo shows. And basically, the long and short of it is this. One day, and hopefully you'll like this as librarians, it occurred to me that I had fallen in love with Richard Price, the writing of Richard Price. I go into a bookstore. I had finished a bunch of his books. I said, you know what? I said, I want a new book. I said, not by him. I said, but I want it by this guy, but a woman, you know, like I want this book, but by a woman. And the clerk in the store, who was very knowledgeable, just kind of froze, and I froze, and we're staring at each other, and I'm watching his wheels turn, one turn and turn, like, you know, thinking of a recommendation. And finally goes, well, me too, but that book doesn't exist. And we start pulling in patrons in the store, other people who work in the store, and we're all going, all right, what was the last book written by a working-class New York woman about us, right? By us and about us. And everyone was like, I can't believe it, but the answer to that is
A Tree Grows in Brooklyn,
which is, as of this year, what, 74 years old?
It's great, but maybe a little dated.
Right, a little dated, right? 74 years. Speaking
of, definitely one of my top three books.
It is. It is one of the, to me, it is definitely one of the greatest books. But it was amazing because we're talking about my mother. That's more than my mother's lifetime. My mother will be happy that I'm reporting she is under 74 years old.
Yes.
So that meant she went her entire lifetime without being represented in a book. Her whole, you know, her life. And even if you cut across genres, if you go from books to film to television, working class women were really absent, you know. And if we're there, we are just this very superficial, you know, one-dimensional character.
The wife of the working class, yes, male protagonist.
Exactly, right? You think of a Scorsese film, right? You go there, you get a woman in a house dressed in a kitchen for like 3 seconds, and it's like, back to De Niro, you know, De Niro, De Niro, De Niro, De Niro, lady in the house dressed, back to De Niro, De Niro, De Niro, that's it, right?
Yeah.
And the lady in the house was actually Scorsese's mother, but, you know, like, we were missing. So, answer to your question, once I heard that, I made a joke. I said, I'm going to write a book, and I am going to call it A Tree Grew in Brooklyn a long effing time ago. And then that joke kind of became a mantra, and I was like, actually, well, maybe I am going to, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to write this book. And so while, you know, the part about my mom being involved with a rich guy, you know, it was of interest to people. I published a story in the New York Times Live section, which got some attention. But the book is as much about that as it is all these other working class women in my life, and women that people aren't used to seeing, that I think, like my grandmother's character, people just bugged out over that character. I was like, who is this? We've never seen her. Or some of my friends growing up, you know, it was really like I knew that these were people that whose lives, you know, were really kind of hidden from the world, you know. And so that was probably my biggest inspiration for writing this book. Yeah.
Very cool. Mm. I mean, definitely the grandmother, your grandmother, the grandmother who is a character in your book because she's your grandmother, reminded me a bit of my own grandmother who was from the Bronx.
Mm.
And just in general, her whole outlook, it kind of brought me back because she hasn't been with me for a while. So really, yeah, I get it. I mean, she felt...
Yeah.
Genuine because she was genuine.
Yeah, so that more than anybody else, people really write me in and go, oh my gosh, you know. So I in part lived with my grandparents when I was a kid, and people writing about that section of the book and just relate to it a lot and really go, wow, this was my life. And then another thing I want to say is that there's this myth of the miserable working class, and that was not my experience at all. And in a way, I started dubbing this my book myself, but I was dubbing it the anti-misery memoir. So it was like not only you had the myth of the miserable working class, and then you have like a, just a world of memoirs that all one seems more miserable than the next. And you know what? And I'm not coming down on that. And there's reasons for those books, and we need those books too. But I was like, you know, it's been a long time since somebody wrote a book that where they're ultimately like, I'm okay. You know, like everything is good with me, and you know, and my life wasn't miserable. And but it's still of interest, and you can still read it. It doesn't need to be like tragic, sensationally awful crap. You know, it's like, you know, just here was a life. It's a little more interesting, I guess, people tell me, than other people's. And it's funny. But just because it's not tragic, and that you know, so I like putting that book into the canon of memoir. You know, I'm like, especially as a woman and a gay woman, you know, we've talked about that, but you know, especially as a gay woman, you know, people really expect your life to have been terrible. And you know, on top of the fact that you grew up working class, like where they people expect it's even worse, right? And it was not at all. My family was like, yeah, it's Tara, whatever. You know, that's Tara. When I was a kid, she was a tomboy. When I was a good old, whatever. No, I mean, it really was okay. I had very accepting, wonderful people around me, even if they weren't the most educated or the most quote unquote progressive people. They loved me, you know, and pretty good stuff.
And that's, I think, extremely important.
I think it's great just because for kids that grow up and like the LGBT, all the
mm-hmm. It's okay. Why no? We keep adding too many for you. I know. LGBT. Yeah.
QIA+.
You could put the QIA+ on there. I know.
But, I mean, all you hear, at least from like the news that like I'll read online or like occasionally listen to or watch, it's always sad stories about something that happened. And to have a book where, yeah, life was good. Like it wasn't end all of the world. I didn't have a horrible experience growing up. And that your family was accepting, it's great for people to have that. Like it can
Be good. I think it was maybe somebody in it. Maybe Elle Magazine, I'm going to forget, but somebody had written that my book contained the funniest coming out story of all time. So I'll just leave that there for you. It also involves my mother, so you should check that chapter out.
You know what? It's interesting because also growing up, you know, reading, I guess, you know, YA as a child and just kind of seeing the history of coming out, you know, coming out in books from, I guess, I think Annie on Her Mind or Annie on My Mind was one of the earliest.
I have never heard of that.
Now we have so many books. But I think there's a difference between topic books, which are very necessary, which are, you know, hey, this is a thing, and you know, some people will feel one way about it, some people will feel the other way about it, and you know, you can come out and with various reactions from characters in the books, you know, are important. But one thing that I've been noticing a lot lately is that there are a lot of books where, you know, the characters just happen to be gay or somewhere and, you know, fall somewhere in on the queer spectrum.
Wow, it's almost like real life.
Yeah, exactly. Almost like
happens to be gay.
It's not a complete central of, it's not a topic book. It's, you know, just as normal as breathing, you know, there's Claire's mom and dad and there's Joe's dad's.
Yes. And I mean, yeah, and that's where we want to go. I mean, I was kind of glad that it was almost like a non-issue. It was the thing talked about the least with my book, I think, was the fact that I was gay. And, you know, there was one or two reviewers, I think, I remember being like, we wanted more and you know, about that. And I was like, there's not any more. I'm sorry, straight person who's reviewing my book. But, you know, your understanding that everything is tragic and terrible and this must have occupied so much of my mental space for years is not true, you know? Like, and so I couldn't make it that way for the sake of the book, you know? There were some individually difficult moments. I mean, also, this book ends at 21. It ends with me when I turn 21. And so, you know, there were other things that happened after that. But that, you know, up until then, I had a good ride, you know? And I had accepting parents.
Yeah.
Well, What was I going to say? So we don't even need to keep going on about it even now, but yeah.
So quick question. Have you found any memoirs since that you've enjoyed that you feel fill the need?
Yes. I got lucky. I read a copy of Educated by Tara Westover when it was just a galley. So we have the same literary agent, actually. And so I had gone for lunch with her a while ago, and she gave me this galley, and I was like, okay, look, you know. And I wrote back right away. I was like, this is going to be the bestsellers list. I was like, this is gonna go bonkers.
I'm running it, but you have Lisa.
No,
I thought you did.
No, I want to. I have a copy of Advanced Reader's copy.
So and do I.
Yeah.
We all have Advanced Reader's. We're just like, oh, I definitely want to read it though.
Yeah. So now it's on the bet. You should all read it. It's really. It's really well done. It's really well written, and it's just fascinating. It's about a woman who grows up in a survivalist household Idaho. So completely just, I mean, really off the grid. I don't think she went to school until she was a late teen for college. Basically, she was homeschooled, quote unquote, if you even want to call it that.
Yeah, it wasn't really.
But anyway, yeah, that's a recent fave.
Like, I could give you my copy because I'm.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of, like, 6 books.
So, I think Stacy and I, we did a book discussion once on Breaking Night. Were you?
Yes.
Have you read Breaking Night at all?
No. Almost to Harvard. Liz.
Oh, Liz I think Marty. I've heard of it. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I didn't know the name.
I don't remember her name. Yeah, I just remember the discussion. Mm-hmm. That's when we had the elderly man come in.
Yeah. All right, yeah. I'm gonna jump in here on you because I will tell you that I had a very, you know, a life that you would think, right? Again, I was a young tomboy in Queens. I was born in 1980. This book is set in the 90s. You know, the last person in the world I thought that was gonna write me a fan letter would be a 90-year-old person in Boca Raton. But lo and behold, you know, that's what I got. You know, people can relate to all kinds of things, you know. So I wouldn't count anybody out. I mean, I'm still, that was the thing that shocks me the most is that I thought, writing this book, well, this will probably only appeal to this sort of small, you know, sliver of the population. And then the book comes out and people write you from everywhere and people are touched and you're like, wow, you know, I can be as underestimating of the world as I think that they are of me. You know, I can be, you know, as prejudiced really about who will like me. That was one of my greatest takeaways. My favorite ever was an email, not an email, Facebook message I got from a woman who wrote the message starts. I'm going to do a Southern accent for you, which will be bad, but she starts off because it made it fun. She said, now, Miss Clancy, I'm writing you from rural Georgia. I'm a grandmama. I'm an evangelical Christian. I must be at least 30 years your senior, and our lives couldn't possibly be more different. But, and I was like, dot, 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 right? And I'm waiting. Here comes the hate. You know, here is going to come something about my gayness or something. And she's like, but, dot, dot, dot. I loved your book, right? My other favorite thing she said was, and I haven't cursed as much in my whole life as you did in chapter 14 alone. Which I was like, that's a great joke. This is an urban book. This is, you know, I mean, just as she said, I mean, we couldn't be more different. And she really loved my book. So,
and that's one thing I think that we do at libraries really, really well is we bring people together and we
through books, through media,
we offer stories that resonate on certain levels with everybody, and we allow people the ability to step outside themselves and live in somebody else's life for a while.
Yeah.
Or at least learn to empathize a little bit.
Yeah. I think there was a great Rebecca Mead piece in New Yorker called The Scourge of Relatability, and I sort of, I can be on that side of things too, you know, where I'm like, you know what, you don't have to relate in order order to enjoy it or be touched or whatever. And I think it's an important thing to remember.
Empathy, I think, is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great place to end. Empathy is important. Good night, folks. Tip your waitress.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. And so once again, this is
Lisa Alder
Stacey Mencher,
Jessica Chotan, and
Tara Clancy.
And we are going to
shut the book.
I was going to say turn the page, but I think shut the book probably sounds a little bit different. Let's close this chapter.
All right,
let's try that again. Ready? Okay. 1, 2, 3. This is Jessica Chotan.
Stacey Mencher.
Lisa Hollander.
And
Tara Clancy.
And we are going to
close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.
Hi, this is a test.
I'm Tara Clancy. How are you?